This week on the Defiant podcast, we speak with Zuko, the founder of Zcash. He's made a massive impact on the space, especially relating to privacy, though he doesn't call it that. And with unprecedented regulations that have come in relating to Tornado Cash, Zuko has an extremely nuanced take. But first, Zuko is a crypto OG, so let's get his and Zcash's story.
Well, I was super interested in computers since I was a little kid, and I got interested in cryptography and encryption because of Phil Zimmerman's pretty good cryptography, pretty good privacy application that was the spark for, or one of the sparks for, the first crypto wars in the 1990s. You know about that story?
No.
This guy named Phil Zimmerman wrote an encryption program for like Windows or MS-DOS or something back in the day. And he distributed it for free to everyone. And it came with a little text file called something like pgp1.txt or something like that on MS-DOS. And that text file was a manifesto that said having private communications between people is an important part of human life, and that this new computer revolution that's happening in the 1990s, it could threaten that, and that cryptography offers a way for us to preserve that part of humanity despite computers.
Is that the CryptoPunk manifesto, or is that a different document?
This is a different document. This is the text file that came with PGP. I don't know the proper title of it. And it is, but it was what I discovered when I was probably about 17 years old, maybe, when I downloaded PGP from a bulletin board system over the phone line. And it was my first exposure to cryptography as political activism. Then there's the Cypherpunks Manifesto from a few years later, which was also very influential on me. That was written by Eric Hughes. And that one, the Cypherpunks Manifesto, really holds up. I haven't reread the PGP text file in a couple of decades. I should reread it and see if it holds up. But the Cypherpunks Manifesto, I reread every few years, and it seems more and more relevant every time. So all of your listeners should go read the Cypherpunks Manifesto by Eric Hughes.
Yep. No, I agree. There's this part about cryptography being like the clippers around kind of the barbed wires that kind of, I don't know, there was this like great metaphor around kind of cryptography being this great tool enabling freedom that really stuck with me from that. Okay, so that kind of opened your eyes into this potential that cryptography can be a tool for activism, and specifically around privacy. So what happened next? Like, did you just, dive straight into becoming a cryptographer and experimenting with all this stuff, or what happened?
Well, let me object. It's not really, for me, it wasn't even then when I was young, it wasn't really about privacy. It was about freedom. And that's why I kind of disagree with your introduction of Zcash as a privacy-focused coin. I don't really think Zcash is a privacy-focused coin, at least in my view. But I don't get to control what Zcash is. So if other people think it's a privacy-focused coin, then it is, because it's yours as much as mine, right? But the way I think about it is people need economic tools, tools to do their lives, which empower them and are fair and open and equitable and give them freedom. And there's a whole lot that needs to go into that that the crypto community has not yet achieved to make it normal for normal people. Like, it has to be usable and make sense, right? And not require education before you can use it. It has to be fast and reliable and all that. And that you can use it. Like you can go buy a coffee or an ice cream without exposing your private information to anyone, without putting yourself at risk. That's just normal. Like that's not a special thing. That should just be the expectation that everyone has about everything.
Yeah, Sugo is holding up his t-shirt that says privacy is normal.
Privacy is normal. It's normal for mainstream things. And I think it's a funny sort of inversion in the popular discourse where some people want to portray tools that give people free expression and free choice as being like radical, weird, novel, newfangled things. And that's the opposite of reality. Like everyone had the ability to spend money freely under their own choice and their own consent and in privacy until about 10 or 15 years ago, maybe. And everyone always had the ability to have a private conversation with their friend with no exposure, no risk, not having to think what other people are going to think about this until like 10 or 15 years ago. So I think I think this is what Phil Zimmerman's manifesto text document might have said back in 1990 or whenever I first read it. I need to reread it, but these kind of tools are really just preserving and restoring normal old time-tested conservative values and social structures.
When you say that changed 10 to 15 years ago, what exactly happened at that point?
What happened was the internet revolution took off, and companies that were trying to figure out how to make products and services that people could use through the internet tried all different business models. And only one of them really worked and scaled up, and that was the advertising business model. And that inevitably led to a concentration of surveillance capitalism in 3 or 4 corporations, and inevitably led to people's private information being mined and exploited for profit, but not profit for the people, profit for the 3 or 4 corporations. And in parallel, or maybe as a consequence of this, various governments around the world saw that and craved the ability to monitor and control all of their population all the time. And so all of our different nations and societies have sort of unwittingly slid into this novel, risky, inhumane situation without anybody really thinking it through or intending it or necessarily being okay with it. This is just how it worked out.
Right. And then it's clear to see how this has happened for information, you know, that's controlled by this huge internet giants, like Facebook, Google. But what about transactions, like the financial system? I think kind of the right now the only or like historically, the way that people have been able to transact privately is pretty much cash, right? Because otherwise, if you're going through the banking system, that's not really private. Or what do you think? And has that changed over time? Just like looking at, like ignoring crypto for now, but just looking at how people have transacted over time.
Yeah. Likewise, things have changed dramatically during my lifetime. In that way, both with cash and with the banking system. In part due to the Patriot Act and before that. So in part due to 9/11 and before that to Richard Nixon's war on drugs, but largely just due to the digitization of life, right? Just computers and information technology and smartphones have made everything digital, and that has accidentally had the side effect of making everyone monitored and vulnerable to these few centralized organizations. But that wasn't the intent, and it's not necessary. But that applies to finances as well. It's kind of distressing to me to hear that young people today think that monitoring and control of people's finances is normal. Because it's not. There's it's brand new. It's that wasn't the way the world was when I was born, and it's not the way, as far as I know, any thriving democratic society has ever survived for long with control of either thoughts and information and speech, or with transactions and economics and a voluntary arrangements between people to cooperate on stuff. Having there be some centralized entity like a mega corporation or a government or two or three of them that has even the possibility of exercising that degree of control over everyone else is really unprecedented in human history. It's never been possible before this information technology took over everything.
Right. So the fact that information was digitized, including banking information, that has enabled power to be concentrated and just that for surveillance to happen by a few entities, right?
Right.
Okay. So that how did that impact kind of your views and your involvement with crypto?
Well, yeah, before Bitcoin, I got really into cryptography for freedom. And specifically for me, it was because, well, two reasons. First of all, freedom is just moral and valuable and necessary for human dignity. But secondly, because freedom is necessary for the economy and national security and like having a stable and thriving society. And so I always thought from the beginning that, like from the beginning, meaning when I discovered Phil Zimmerman's program and manifesto and the cypherpunks mailing list and the internet and all this exciting stuff, the World Wide Web and DigiCash. I thought this is the stuff that can enable people to cooperate across distances and across national borders around the world. And human cooperation is one of those things that has a network effect, like having 1,000 people in your community that you can share with or trade with or cooperate with is much more limiting than if you have 1 million people or if you have 1 billion people. The more people you can share with and help each other out, the more everyone benefits. So I thought this whole internet thing is really going to unlock the potential for humanity to benefit one another and benefit themselves and make everything better for everyone going forward. But it also needs economics. Like the internet just gave us the ability to communicate with each other freely, more or less. Like it really changed everything. People don't realize how you couldn't really chat or communicate with people from other countries before the internet. But you also need the ability to share resources, to donate, to co-invest, to start a joint project together and have both sides have obligations and all that. And that really unlocks the human ability to create more and more value for everyone. So that was my whole, so that's why ever since then, people perceive some things I've worked on, like DigiCash, and I worked on PGP at one point, and different decentral, end-to-end encrypted file storage and Zcash, and they perceive it as privacy. And I always think to myself, I don't think that's exactly what it means to me. It's okay if it means that to you. But when people say privacy, to some people, it means secrecy, like choosing not to share or expose something about yourself. That's privacy. And that's valid, but I'm also about choosing to share and expose yourself to people, right? So it's more about consent or control over your own fate and what you choose to share about yourself, your personhood, with who else you choose to share with. That's all about consent and freedom and being able to be your authentic self. And the people who choose to share things with certain people are just as valid as the people who choose not to share. So I'm not so much about secrecy, more about consent.
To swap crypto, a user has to choose among hundreds of DEXs on multiple networks, all offering different rates and fees. Do you want to avoid that hassle? Swap on 1inch, a DEX aggregator built to get you better rates than any single DEX. Enjoy unlimited liquidity across multiple networks and top-level security. Get 1inch on your phone now or swap on 1inch.io. Privacy remains one of the hottest issues in crypto. And if you're using the biggest blockchains, Bitcoin and Ethereum, your transactions are radically transparent on-chain. But is this what users want? And is it even aligned with what Satoshi himself originally wanted?
That makes a lot of sense. I think the reason why privacy in relation to Zcash is highlighted is because the default for the kind of most well-known blockchains and cryptocurrencies is to not have that ability to consent to disclosing or not disclosing. It's like everything is public and out there.
And that's the aberration. That's the weird thing, which is totally different from cash, is totally different from the banking system, is totally different from credit cards. That whole radical transparency that came out of Bitcoin and got copied into Ethereum is historically unprecedented. It's radical and risky and weird and probably totally unacceptable to almost all normal users for almost all normal usages. And the only reason it's there is because Satoshi couldn't figure out how to include the privacy that he wanted to include in the first version of Bitcoin. Do you know about that story, how that worked out?
No.
Well, the whole idea of Bitcoin from the beginning, I don't know if you know, but I'm the author of the first blog post ever written about Bitcoin. And when
I didn't know that.
When Satoshi put up the Bitcoin.org homepage, like 2009 or 2008 or whatever, when he was launching it, he linked to my blog on the homepage because I don't have any secret information about Satoshi's identity, and I don't want to because you should respect other people's consent about things like that, like we were talking about. But it's clear that Satoshi came from the same community I did, right? The same ethos of political goals with technological means. So, yeah, so I exchanged a couple of messages with Satoshi on the Bitcoin Talk forum, and a lot of the other people who were involved in Bitcoin from the very earliest days, we all used to hang out together on the same IRC channels. IRC was the chat room for coder activists back then. And I contributed some security auditing to Bitcoin in the early days and stuff. So my point was, me and Satoshi and Hal Finney and all of the other contributors who were much more important than me for the early development of Bitcoin considered freedom to be the point. Like, why do all this? Why is it better? Why should it exist? Answer, freedom. And privacy was a necessary part of freedom. So it was freedom from central banks. So you had the non-discretionary monetary policy, and it was freedom from any actors out there who want to monitor and control everyone else's financial activity. And so it needed privacy. That was the ethos and the discussion among all the developers. But we just failed. We just couldn't figure out how to do it. And I couldn't either. Like, not that I was that involved. Like, Bitcoin was a revelation to me. And once I saw it, and I posted that blog post in like 2009, that was the first time I started really taking it seriously and trying to contribute to it. But from that point forward, nobody could figure out how to make Bitcoin private. And in 2010, Satoshi and some other folks had a conversation about this on the Bitcoin Talk Forum, where Satoshi said, somebody suggested, ooh, we could add encryption into Bitcoin if only we had zero knowledge proofs. And they looked into that, and Satoshi said, yeah, he said something like, and I really like the way he phrased it. I really admire Satoshi in so many ways. And one of them was he phrased it in terms of user experience, right? For normies. That's how he talked about it. He said, yeah, if we could figure out how to use zero knowledge proofs, we could make a much more usable, easier version of Bitcoin. But they couldn't. The zero knowledge proofs in 2010 weren't scientifically mature enough. So they looked at it, they studied it, and they said, no, it won't work. And then about 4 months after that, Satoshi disappeared from the internet forever. And then about 3 years after that, a bunch of other scientists came up with a breakthrough in zero knowledge proofs, which made them efficient enough that we could use it in Bitcoin. So then those scientists proposed it at the 2013, I think, or 2012. I think it was the 2013 San Jose Bitcoin Conference. They said, look, hey, everybody, there's these new zero knowledge proofs, and we figured out how you can combine encryption and Bitcoin together using zero knowledge proofs. It's like blockchain is this thing. Like, encryption is this thing that Phil Zimmerman and a bunch of other people had developed decades earlier and had successfully made it part of humanity's legacy of known science and known tools to have encryption. And that was the first crypto wars in the 1990s to prevent different arms of the U.S. government from like banning it or making it a nest, military secret or whatever. And then Satoshi discovered blockchain in like 2008, 2009. And that was the first time we had decentralized shared state in computer science. But, and then Satoshi tried to combine the two and couldn't. Why? Because we didn't have zero knowledge proofs yet. So the third thing is zero knowledge proofs. With zero knowledge proofs, you can combine encryption and blockchain. So where was I? So these scientists proposed that. They saw how you could combine blockchain, like the append-only property, the immutability property of blockchain with the end-to-end encryption property of cryptography. And they proposed it at the 2013 San Jose Bitcoin Conference as an upgrade to Bitcoin. They said, look, here's a change we can make to the Bitcoin protocol that would enable this. And the Bitcoin core developers who were present, I forget which ones, there were lots of them, of the Bitcoin core devs from that era, from 2013 era, who were at that conference. And they had a slot on stage to give a talk. And at the beginning, they said, okay, we're going to give our talk, but first we got to talk about this new proposal that everyone is, we hear the buzz that everyone's talking about, this new idea to add this zero knowledge proof based encryption into Bitcoin. And we just want to be clear, we're definitely not going to do that anytime soon. It's way too new and inefficient and risky, and Bitcoin's way too important to be like experimenting on. So, sorry about that. So, people should try that out in an altcoin first, and then if it proves out, we could consider adding it into Bitcoin in the future. So that was the end of the upgrade Bitcoin dream that Satoshi had dreamed about like 3 years earlier before he disappeared. And so then those scientists contacted me and they said, well, I already knew about, I'd read their science papers. I knew about their work. And I thought, based on my knowledge of cryptography and information security and computer science and software engineering, I thought this is the first thing that could actually work. This is the first ever design that could combine global open decentralization with end-to-end encryption. But, well, even more so with privacy, with effective privacy. Okay, because I was familiar already with things like Monero, mixers, the whole idea of like make a different Bitcoin address every time you do anything. And I knew that none of those would ever work. So when I saw this new science proposal, I was really excited. I was like, yes, that's the first thing that could ever actually work. And then, much to my delight, the scientist behind it called me and said, we've invented this cool thing and we want it to become an industrial strength, widely used tool. And they said, we're beginning to realize that this won't happen as a side effect of our grad student's PhD thesis. So, you know, but the next part of the story is I said, no. I said, Bitcoin already has a head start, right? And I imagine that Bitcoin could be the mainstream thing that everyone uses for all their business activities and savings and transactions. So if I spent the rest of my life making this alternative that had this added privacy feature, you know, this is the story of why, this is the story of how I realized that it's not about privacy. But we'll get to that. Like we said at the beginning of this conversation. So but I told them no when they called. Because I said, well, you know, I could spend like more or less the rest of my life trying to make that work. But if it was only used by like that tiny subset of people who are especially libertarian or they're currently being hacked or something, and so they really need privacy, then it wouldn't really help society that much if Bitcoin was the main, Bitcoin remained the mainstream economic tool. And then I slept on it, and the next morning I was thinking, wait, you can't use something that exposes all of your private data for your business investments or your business operations or your payroll or your personal savings or your retail purchases or your loans or anything. So actually, Bitcoin cannot be the mainstream thing. So that's when I called them back the next day. It said I was willing to set aside everything else I was doing with my life and commit to making Zcash.
Wow. Amazing.
So that's why I don't think it's about privacy. I just think it's just what you need to have a normal old-fashioned economic system that everyone can participate in safely, like they expect.
Accelerate your Web3 journey with Apex Pro. Apex Pro is leading participants with diverse backgrounds and knowledge to a new era of Web3 social trading. Access perpetual contract trades with up to 20x leverage on popular USDC collateralized trading pairs on a powerful trading engine. Scale to accelerate trades and increase usability while preserving your privacy and security. Grow and manage your wealth fairly and transparently with Apex Pro.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And it should be obvious, but still, Bitcoin and Ethereum are, you know, the most popular cryptocurrencies, and they don't offer those safeguards, so or that ability to consent. So why do you think that's the case? Like, I get like the head start, and that's, you know, a huge advantage to Bitcoin, but you know, in this decade plus, maybe, you know, the price, like blockchains that do offer that option of having or not having privacy could have taken off and surpassed it. Why do you think that hasn't happened?
That's a good point about the head start. And the head start was largely originally on technology grounds, because like Satoshi and the other Bitcoiners were trying to add privacy, but we didn't have the necessary technology yet. Zcash launched in 2016. The zero knowledge proof breakthrough that we needed came out in 2013. And then we worked as fast as possible to launch Zcash as soon as possible in order to make sure it was available to everyone before it got banned and that worked. And it's still not banned. So there's the head start on technology. There's the head start on all those other network effects, liquidity, branding, the network effect of developers on Ethereum. And also another reason why I think it hasn't changed yet is the most people not really understanding the consequences of it yet. But I think that's been changing. Like if you think back, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, like maybe before Cambridge Analytica, before sort of a bunch of hacks, there was a widespread complacency or disinterest in these issues. And I feel like that's really changing. Now there's like dissatisfaction and concern, but a sort of widespread nihilism that there's nothing that can be done. Like we're all doomed. But I think that'll change too, right? Because we're totally not doomed. Like there are working alternatives that support human rights and human dignity and a more vigorous and resilient economy. And so I think people are going to become more and more aware of it going forward.
Is Zcash able to support all the computation and dApps that Ethereum supports?
Great question. No, but let me spin a possible hypothesis for you and see what you think. No, Zcash started life as a clone of the Bitcoin design. So the same old proof of work mining, like almost everything the same. And we just added the protection optionally for users who wanted protection of their like assets. And it only supports the ZEC token. There's no other tokens on Zcash other than the ZEC token. And it doesn't support any smart contracts or dApps. But there are some virtues to that. Simpler and like fewer things can go wrong. And I have this hypothesis that I'd be interested in your feedback on, Camila. If I open my phone and I want to like Snapchat my friends, I have no information or concern about what cloud services the backend is using. Is it using AWS? Is it using a Facebook data center or both? I don't care, right? I don't care which data center it uses. My hypothesis is that's going to be true of Web3 apps. You're going to open your phone. You're going to be like, oh, I want to chat with my friends and maybe send and share NFTs with them while I'm at it or whatever. Play games, send it, like pay them back for dinner or whatever. And you are not going to know and not going to care which blockchain or blockchains are behind that. You're going to care about what apps your friends are on so that you can text them or you know, interact with them, or your business partners. If you need to like engage in a contract or pay some bills or whatever, you really care which tool you can use to get the money or the contract to the right counterparties. You're going to care about the user experience, like what it lets you do and how normal and easy it is to do it. And I think you're going to care about the asset. Like even though you don't care about the blockchain, you don't know whether it's on Ethereum or Zcash or Bitcoin or Avalanche or Solana. You've never heard of those and you don't care and you don't want to care any more than you care about AWS US East 1 versus Google Cloud Center 2 or whatever, all relevant to you. But you really care about the difference between ETH and BTC and ZEC. Those are your financial investments and may also like signal your affiliation or your enthusiasm or how you feel like you're part of a group, like your friend group or a political movement, or at least your financial investment for your long-term or whatever. So that's my thesis. My hypothesis. I want to know what you think. People, once we have actual usable mainstream apps, then people are not going to know or care what blockchain it uses, but they're going to care about who uses it, how usable it is, and what assets they have in it.
In the roller coaster that's crypto right now, traders are looking for ways to smooth the bumpy ride. Pod's Yield wants to help with just that. Pod's staked ETH volatility vault is designed to earn more both when ETH price goes up and when ETH price goes down. It's not a matter of if, but when the price will move. Pods uses volatility in holders' favor and makes more ETH whenever the price bounces. Find out more on pods.finance. Zcash aims to provide users the choice to transact privately in crypto. Suho believes the ability to consent to what information is made public is more about freedom than privacy, and he thinks eventually this will be expected in the blockchain space. But what do private transactions actually look like? Well, it so happens that Suho sent me a transaction over Zcash. So let me show you.
Yeah, there's at least a really good probability of that because ZEC currently works for that. Like, I sent you an encrypted ZEC transaction before we started this call. If you check your ZEC wallet, you'll see like about a thousandth or a hundredth of a ZEC in there, along with an encrypted note that both the money and the note are visible only on your phone and my phone, and no other person or device anywhere in the world has any knowledge. All the rest of the world has zero knowledge about that transaction.
So that means that somebody could go to like the Zcash Explorer and look at that transaction and kind of not see what's in it.
You should definitely do this. Look at that transaction on your phone. It's got a transaction ID. Are you doing it right now?
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Okay, I have my Zcash wallet. Okay. And then what? I've never used this before. So, do I go to history? Oh, messages. Oh, okay. I see that. Let's see.
All right, you got a transaction. It's kind of blurry, but if you touch it, does it show you the amount and the note?
Okay, it says, the note says, thank you for including me in your podcast, Suho.
Okay, that's the one I sent.
Nice, okay.
Now, you can probably get the TX ID. Have you ever looked up Ethereum transactions on a Block Explorer?
Yep. Okay, I see this here. All right, okay, I see a transaction ID.
So cut and paste the transaction ID, open a Block Explorer. I would recommend blockchair.com. Like, blockchain, but with an R instead of the N, so now it spells blockchair.
And okay, I've just copied the transaction ID.
Okay, so now you can see everything that the public, like the Zcash miners and all the Block Explorers and Chainalysis and everyone else in the world, can see certain things on the blockchain. But what's interesting is what they can't see, right? So if you scroll down, it'll say like...
Shielded.
Yeah, it says... Sender colon shielded. And that means there's zero knowledge about which address or wallet or person sent that transaction. Then it says receiver colon shielded. There's zero knowledge on the blockchain about your wallet or your address or anything else you've ever previously done, right? And there's zero knowledge about the amount you received.
Well, it does say transferred from shielded pool, and it says the amount. It says 0.00001 ZEC.
Well, that's the fee that I paid to the miners.
Okay, so it says transfer from pool that amount, and then it says transaction fee.
The amount sent is end-to-end encrypted, so...
Yeah, you're right. It's a different amount. So you send me 0.01...
Right,
ZEC.
A hundredth of a ZEC.
Okay, so what blockchain is showing is actually the fee, not
the transaction fee that I paid to the miner. So the amount that I'm paying to the miner is publicly visible, because any miner, like the first miner that mines the block, gets to collect that amount. So you can't really end-to-end encrypt it because any miner can get it and see it. And also, it doesn't give away anything because every transaction pays the same amount to the miner. A mining fee is not private information. Now, the fact that I sent you one when Hudson Fazek is private information and nobody, BlockShare doesn't know that, only you and me and in the future, all your podcast listeners know how much that guy sent you. But that is consensual on our part, right? Like, we chose to disclose that, and that's fine. That's valid. We don't have to be super secretive in order to be valid. That's why consent is more important than privacy. Oh, and there's one more thing that's in there that nobody can see, and that's the message. The encrypted memo is encrypted from my device to your device, and neither BlockShare nor any Chainalysis company nor anybody else can access that other than your device and my device and anyone that we consensually choose to share it with.
Right. And that's, you know, that's also obviously different from transacting on Ethereum, where those memos are also public.
Right. Yeah, very different.
And what you were saying before... Oh, go ahead.
Do you know about encrypted love notes in the blockchain?
on Zcash?
Uh-huh.
No.
There are at least five. I've lost count of how many couples have told me or shown me like selfies or whatever. Like two of them exchanged encrypted love notes through the Zcash blockchain as part of their wedding ceremony. Two different couples, two different weddings. But they showed me like selfies of having their wedding ceremony and like sharing encrypted love notes in the Zcash blockchain as part of their wedding ceremony. A third one, they exchanged encrypted love notes to the Zcash blockchain when they were like first dating. And then like 4 years later, they got married. So this is actually a thing. There's a trend.
They're so which cute.
You're combining the permanence of a blockchain with the privacy of just you and me and who we consensually choose to include, right? So I kind of like to imagine it's like you're carving your initials into a tree trunk with a love heart, but anybody else who walks by, they just see the normal tree trunk because it's like a magical thing, but only the two lovers, when they walk by, they see their initials in the tree trunk.
Oh, I like that analogy. That's really romantic. Okay, and then I think it's interesting to include what you were telling me before about sending Zek to and from Coinbase. How does that work? I mean, the fact that you're using a centralized exchange with this technology.
I think when people think about privacy, they get confused, and I do too. I've learned that if I try to think about a different word or think about it in a different way than the word privacy, it makes... helps me not get confused. So a lot of people have chatted with me and they say the following thing. They say, oh, I care about privacy. I want to try using Zcash. And I'm like, great, go ahead. Like, install a wallet. Let me know how it goes. And then they get back to me like a week later and they say, oh, I couldn't find a non-KYC exchange that would sell me Zcash. So I can't get Zcash privately. So I give up. And I think that's really wrong and confused. And if they would just try it, they would realize that you get, how do I put this? I could say it using the word privacy. Let me try saying it using the word privacy. And then we see if I could say it better or differently without using the word privacy. So the way to say it with the word privacy is you get privacy from having a Zcash wallet. Like Camila, when you installed Zek wallet or whatever that one is, on your phone, from that point forward, any Zcash you put into that phone, you get privacy around that. And it doesn't matter if the Zcash came from Coinbase. You go ahead and like log into your Coinbase account and buy some Zcash and withdraw it to your phone sometime and tell me if I'm right. So that's one way to think about it. If you say it without the word privacy, then I guess I think it would help. You would say like, you would either say one of two things. I don't want people, including Coinbase, to know what I do with my money. Or you could even say, I don't want Coinbase or the US government that they report to or whatever to know that I bought Zcash. But now that you choose one, don't use the word privacy. Now you got to pick one, right? Now you're going to think more clearly. Because the word privacy could mean either, but if you have to pick one, now you get to think clearly that you can't buy Zcash from Coinbase without Coinbase knowing that you bought Zcash from Coinbase. Okay? So if this is the one you want, then yeah, you've got to find a different exchange or meet someone face-to-face in the park or whatever. But if it's the other one that you want, like, I want to have money in my pocket, I'm going to buy something with it at some point, and I just want that to be between me and them, right? Well, in that case, it's fine to buy your Zcash from Coinbase. You buy your Zcash from Coinbase, you withdraw it into your wallet, you keep it there, and it's just like, do you ever hold cash in your pocket?
I mean, not so much anymore, but...
Right, okay, so I'm an increasingly rare person. Like, young people today apparently never walk around with cash in their pockets, but when I was a kid, you walked around with cash in your pocket, and the security and the consent properties you get from Zcash are a lot like that. Like, I go to the bank, the bank teller or the ATM or whatever knows my identity. I withdraw $100 from the bank and I put it in my pocket. And now at some point I'm like, hey, I want an ice cream. Hey, I want to buy a used bike, whatever it is. But that part has nothing to do with the bank, right? The bank has no knowledge, no control, no responsibility for whether I buy an ice cream or a used bike or what, right? And that's the way Zcash works. You can go to Coinbase. Coinbase is basically a bank, right? It knows your KYC information. It has a scan of your driver's license or whatever. You can withdraw $100 worth of Zcash into your phone. And from that point forward, Coinbase has zero knowledge or control over what you do with your phone, the Zcash in your phone.
If somebody were to identify or link your identity with your Zcash address, they could do that, but I guess they wouldn't be able to get a lot of information from that, right?
Yeah, like we did earlier in that live demo that we did. Remember how you scroll through Blockchair and you say from --shielded? That's because your address doesn't appear on the blockchain. So that's really different. And I'm glad you did it, because when people actually walk through it, then they realize, oh, wait, I've always assumed that addresses appear on the blockchain. Like, all Bitcoin addresses appear on the Bitcoin blockchain. All Ethereum addresses appear on the Ethereum blockchain. But Zcash shielded addresses just never get posted. So if someone knew, like, I know an address of yours because you texted it to me so that I could send you that test transaction, right? But even knowing that address, if I go look through the Block Explorer, I can't tell how many transactions or which transactions or with whom or how much or what encrypted love notes you're exchanging with someone else on the Zcash blockchain, because even though I know your address, I can't learn anything about you.
Interesting. Okay. That's totally different from Ethereum and Bitcoin. What do you think about, you know, criticism that these types of technologies, and then, you know, going back to the beginning of the interview, what Tornado Cash is trying to, like, Tornado Cash is trying to make something like this work on Ethereum. And that's why it's been sanctioned, because criminals or hackers or this group that's linked to North Korea was using Tornado Cash for some illicit activity. So there's this criticism that privacy-enabling technology is being used by criminals, and therefore that technology should be shut down, or that technology is evil, or, you know, shouldn't be out there.
Well, I disagree with that idea. I think freedom and consent are normal and are good for society, and that it's part of the American way and American values. And that's why nobody's trying to immigrate to North Korea. And they are trying to immigrate to America. Why? Because our values are better, including this one. But I also would kind of push back on the general idea that everyone thinks that, or that the government thinks that. Like, the OFAC sanctions against Tornado Cash weren't targeting privacy. They were targeting the horrible regime of North Korea and the hackers there who have stolen billions of dollars from innocent people. like that's, I think it's weird and interesting that they added a smart contract to a list that has formerly only held people and the property of those people, when a smart contract is not a person nor the property of a person, but it's more like a protocol. We'll see how that plays out. I honestly, not to cast aspersions, but I honestly wonder if they realized what they were doing, since the Secretary of State, apparently, I saw the tweet, the deleted tweet, where the Secretary of State said that Tornado Cash was a North Korean government operation, which he then deleted. so they might have, we don't know yet because they haven't, there's a lot of unanswered questions about what's going on. But I would definitely say there's an overgeneralization that a lot of crypto people have understandably jumped to, which is really broad generalization, like the government hates privacy and is taking steps to destroy it. And that's a huge leap, right? Like, for a lot of reasons. For one thing, different kinds of privacy are required by the government. Like, if you run a business, you're not allowed to disclose your customers' private financial data under the wrong circumstances or to the wrong people. For another thing, the Fourth Amendment and maybe other amendments to the Bill of Rights enshrine freedom from unreasonable search and seizure as a fundamental right of all American citizens. For another thing, there are all these regulators who have different responsibilities. Not all of them are counterterrorism regulators all the time. There's also consumer protection, investor protection, child protection, health information protection, market efficiency, systemic stability, and a bunch of other goals and like mandates that different regulators have. And a lot of those regulators have approved and supported the deployment of Zcash specifically more than a lot of other things. Like, if you look into it, Zcash has A, been mentioned positively by a lot of regulators, US federal regulators in different ways, and B, has been added and supported by a lot of regulated entities, like the big regulated US exchanges all support Zcash, Grayscale, the Anchorage got the first nationwide banking license for a crypto company, and the letter from the banking regulator mentioned Zcash as one of the tokens that, or the coins that Anchorage supported, and so on and so forth. Like, there's a lot more that people are really overgeneralizing or drawing their own, like, sort of confirming what they always suspected or what they thought was an interesting story in the first place. And then because of this Tornado Cash news, they're like, aha, this is exactly what's happening. But it's a lot different in detail.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what comes out of this. I think we'll have to see innovation result from this and hopefully just bring this space forward in a way that it makes it more censorship resistant.
Yeah, I think that's right.
In the last 10 years, over $100 billion worth of crypto has been lost or stolen specifically because of poor key management, scams, and hackers. My new sponsor, ZenGo Crypto Wallet, wants to change the game entirely by creating a crypto wallet with no private key vulnerability. ZenGo aims to be the most secure Web3 wallet and the best place to keep your crypto, NFTs, and assets secure. After all, with no private key to steal, your crypto assets and NFTs are much more difficult to hack. Get started at zengo.com/defiant and use code DEFIANT to get $20 back on your first purchase of $200 or more. That's C-E-N-G-O bitcoin.com/defiant. Terms and conditions apply, so check out their site for details. The level of control governments have leveled at the space that was seen as censorship resistant has sent crypto enthusiasts spiraling. What does this mean for the future? And what's stopping governments from imposing sanctions on Zcash itself? Is that a concern for Zuko? And with all that's happening with these sanctions, what's in the pipeline for Zcash?
Well, I certainly hope that doesn't happen, because nobody wants thieves and madmen with nukes to be empowered and to be part of their world, part of their society or community or ecosystem. I think we really don't know. Like, again, with the Tornado Cash stuff, we just don't know the facts yet, right? Like, we don't know if there's going to be any charges, if there's going to be any other arrests, if the guy they arrested, they're just going to let him go, if they're going to charge him with something. If they are going to charge him with something, with what? In the Netherlands. We also don't know what's going to happen with the OFAC sanctions of the Tornado Cash protocol. Like, how is that? This has never been done before. How's it going to work? There's a lot of legal questions and practical questions. And I think it's kind of cute how the crypto community, there are a bunch of hackers who like computer science, and there are a bunch of like activists and idealists who like to build a better society in a new way. And they're kind of like, the crypto community's like reaction cycle is so much shorter than the government's reaction cycle. Like, within 24 hours, 48 hours or something new they're doing, 72 hours or something new they're doing. But it's going to take weeks before we even figure out if, like, what was the intention of OFAC, much less what's going to happen with those, with that that sanction action that they took.
So to you, I guess, like, it's hard to say because there's so many questions, but are you, I guess, like, this concern that that the U.S. government can come after, like, privacy-enabling technologies, to you that's not so much a concern, because it's clear that that's kind of a respected right in the U.S., and it's really the reason that they did it is probably, you know, something unrelated to privacy and like freedom of transacting, etc.
I'm struggling to avoid like climbing out on the branch of hypotheticals, right? Like, the facts are that OFAC is a tool of United States foreign policy intended to influence the behavior of these despots and drug lords or whatever around the world. And the fact is that the Office of the Comptroller and the Currency of the Currency and the SEC and the New York Department of Financial Services and the CFTC and 99 other organizations have different mandates and different behavior historically, in particular with regard to Zcash. Like, if you look into it, Zcash is supported on more or less every highly regulated. Oh, hey, I got to get going soon. That was my alarm. If you look into it, Zcash is currently supported on more or less every highly regulated USA company. And the other fact is that the United States has the Fourth Amendment, which enshrines the right of the people to be free from unreasonable search and seizure of their papers and effects. And the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment is a right to due process. So those are all facts. Maybe after we find out what the hell is going on with Tornado Cash and Alexei, then we could analyze and draw conclusions, like, what does this mean, or what does it mean for the future? But right now, it's sheer speculation. We don't even know what is happening or what the various parties involved intended or what they did or what they were alleged to have done.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I think we'll just have to be patient, which is not, I think, a very common virtue in crypto.
The crypto industry is strong suit. It's just waiting and like withholding judgment until you know the facts.
No. If you have 5 minutes, I'd love to kind of hear what's kind of coming next for Zcash, like what's exciting.
So Zcash is a decentralized open source project, and my company, the Electric Coin Company, we're the ones who originally built it back in the day in that story that I told you once I decided to commit my life to building this technology for the world. Then I recruited the Avengers, like the superhero team of all time of cryptographers and security experts and software engineers. And we built and launched that thing, and that gave rise to the zero knowledge proof industry. Like Zcash was the reason why zero knowledge proofs became an industrial strength proven tool, and other people started building on top of it. And then nowadays, the Zcash community has elected to fund a bunch of other organizations outside of my company, the Electric Coin Company. The Zcash community has this consensual thing called the Dev Fund that they came up with a couple of years ago, where they decided to allocate issuance out of the Zcash issuance schedule to fund Zcash support orgs. And they allocated 2/3 of that to other organizations outside of the Electric Coin Company and 1/3 of it to the Electric Coin Company. Okay, so there's a lot of other people that you should invite onto your podcast and find out what their plans are for the future of Zcash. But what the Electric Coin Company is working on is three things. First, shifting Zcash from proof of work to proof of stake, because we thought that would be a good idea. We always thought it would be a good idea. We like actually, we talked about it in like 2017 or something with Vitalik. And Vitalik said something. You can find this tweet if you want. Vitalik tweets something like, move Zcash to proof of stake. And I tweet something like, I'm waiting to see Ethereum do it first and see what blows up.
Well, you're about to see.
Exactly. Yeah. So we think the time has come. And it's a lot of work. You know, we met the Ethereum folks before the first launch. They hired us to do security audits of Ethereum before like the first mainnet. And ever since we've known them, they've been working on proof of stake, and it's always been like 2 years out the whole time. But so we know that it's a lot of work to make that jump, way more work than just launching a brand new thing on proof of stake. But that's our priority. The second priority comes along with it, and that's interop. And that goes like interop between, not just between blockchains, but between products and services. Like if you open a wallet and you look at it, is it all in that one wallet, or do you need to open two different apps and cut and paste between them to get what done what you want to get done or whatever? So that's that story that I was telling you earlier, where in the future people aren't going to know or care what blockchain it's on. They're just going to care about what it can get done with which assets and with which counterparties. So that's our second strategy at the Electric Coin Company's interop. And then the third one is building our own wallet, just to push forward the state of the art of usability. Right? I'm totally dissatisfied with how confusing and error prone and risky and inconvenient all the crypto apps are. Well, almost all. So the Electric Coin Company is building our own user interface front end so that we can integrate it with the back end and find out how usable can you make this? How intuitive, how fast, how reliable. So that's the third thing we're doing.
Very cool. Super exciting to see. We'll be following along on the Defiant. And then finally, to wrap up, I want to ask you, how are you Defiant?
I am Defiant. I have this imagination, which I get mostly from fiction. Like, have you ever read 1984? Everyone, pause this podcast and go read 1984 and then come back. 1984 by George Orwell. So I have this really deep-seated sentiment, which is, I'm just never going to love Big Brother. You can, maybe the tyrants and the criminals of the world can outplay me. Maybe they can have me assassinated or something. But I'm just never going to, what's the word? Submit. That's
a good word. I love it. I think a lot of defiant audience members are thinking on the same lines as you are. And that's why we have crypto, luckily, right?
Yeah. Thanks,
amazing.
Satoshi.
Amazing, Zuko. Thanks, Satoshi. Yes. And thanks, Zuko. It's been a pleasure. Really, thank you so much for taking the time to chat about such important topics. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Camila.